Thanks, Gary. My name's Debbie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi. Can you hear me okay if I sit back like this? Yeah?
Yep.
Good. Okay. Well, thank you, Gary, and thanks to Billy for asking me to join you all today. Those two paragraphs, I know that this meeting always reads those, but they were particularly poignant today because I spent a lot of time coming to your group over the years before I moved to Colorado, and I see an old friend, Ivy, seems to be on there for my home group where I got sober and spent the first 19 years of my sobriety up in the D.C. area. And of course, Lynn and Billy and a couple others are just great longtime friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the kind of friends and relationships that I was completely incapable of being a part of before I came to you all, well, for many years into AA as well, but especially before I got here. So I just love those paragraphs that you read. They have particular meaning right now as I've been visiting lots of friends in various places over these Zoom meetings, and I don't know where I'm going to start. I have all kinds of ideas and thoughts going right now, but maybe since it went there, you know, the fact that we're able to meet like this and join each other from not just around the country, but I've been in meetings with people from all over the world, and, you know, I'm doing a good job at making sure I'm sticking to my regular local meetings because I don't want those to lose their membership and not have enough people there for any newcomers joining. But it's really been a joy to add and go to some meetings with people like this in other places, see familiar faces, and get to see a lot of people I wouldn't ordinarily see. So, you know, of all people, some of you have heard me share this. When all this happened and we started meeting on Zoom, I couldn't help but think, what more well-equipped group of people could there be to make this work and to be okay throughout this time period, you know? And for me, that reason is because when I came to AA, I was taught very quickly, be part of the solution. You know, I had lived in the problem for a long time, and at times in my sobriety when I have fallen back into living in the problem again, it doesn't go so well. I know what I get left to my own devices. I have been taught to be part of the solution. So this happened, you know, my work shuts down, moves to home. They say, wear a mask, fine, I'll wear a mask. Don't go anywhere, fine, I won't go anywhere. You know, don't meet with my A group, fine, I'll meet with you. This, whatever it is to help be part of the solution for the greater whole, we've been taught to do that. So, you know, thank goodness, right? We have this little extra oomph to us, I think, to get through this time period and to be with each other this way. And the only thing I've worried about is people who are coming to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. And there have been plenty of them. I'm sure you've seen it too, showing up in their first ever meetings this way. And I can't even imagine, and I'm so grateful they're finding us and that they're there, but something that I and the women I sponsor are trying to do is, you know, it's really easy to put our numbers in the chat box and say, hey, call me if you need to talk. And I saw that happening at first, and I thought back to when I was new, and there is no chance I would have been willing to reach out and call a random phone number from somebody I had never met, didn't know. So we're trying to see whatever we can do to get their phone numbers, you know, whether it's private chats, if certain meetings allow that, whatever we can do to get those newcomers' phone numbers so we can reach out to them just like we would do in person at a meeting, right? Because I want to help us maintain whatever we can to welcome those people to Alcoholics Anonymous and to take that fear of the great unknown as much as possible. But I don't know about you guys, but I had a whole lot of that when I came to AA, and I had come around in and out of AA a little bit, and finally someone said to me, well, I spent a couple of years in and out, which I'll tell you more about in a few minutes, but I spent a couple of years in and out, and finally someone said to me, you know, you're sitting on this fence. You have one foot hanging over here with us, kind of sticking your little toe in, testing the waters, and you have your other leg over the other side back where you came from. And you know what's there. You know exactly what you have to go back to. All the misery that includes, you're well aware. But for me, that was oftentimes more comfortable to go back to drinking and to the answers and the solution that I knew. And this AA member said to me that day, you have no idea what's in store for you. in Alcoholics Anonymous. You have no idea what's ahead. So I hope you stick with us and find out for yourself because it is more wonderful than any of us can tell you. So whatever we can do to help people showing up in AA for the first time over the internet like this, that is still the case. You know, I'm willing to try and do that. So I thought of another part in the book too when Billy asked me to speak here. And it's in A Vision for You, which people read from all the time, you know, and in the very couple first pages, it's really talking about the terror, right? The four horsemen, the misery of our alcoholism, the frustration, the despair, and about how we get to that point where we're in this dilemma of, for me, for sure, I related to this. I could not imagine continuing on the way I was drinking, and I could not imagine not drinking anymore, and how I would put my head down on a pillow and make it to sleep at night without drinking. So that's what it's describing in these first couple pages. But then it shifts a little bit and it tells us, yes, there is a substitute for us. And it's vastly more than that. It's a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you'll find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship and so will you. And then it goes on, and this is the part that I particularly thought of after getting off the phone with Billy and seeing Lynn recently on a Monday night women's meeting. It says, you're going to meet these new friends in your own community. Near you, alcoholics are dying helplessly like people in a sinking ship. These are future fellows of Alcoholics Anonymous. Among them, you will make lifelong friends. You will be bound to them with new and wonderful ties, for you will escape disaster together. And you will commence shoulder to shoulder your common journey. Then you will know what it means to give of yourself that others may survive and rediscover life. You will learn the full meaning of love thy neighbor as thyself. And I feel like that is the perfect description. New and wonderful ties that bind me to people like Lynn, Billy, Ivy, who I've known throughout much of my sobriety. And that's what we get here. I had no idea. You know, I didn't want that. I just was desperate for someone to tell me how I didn't have to drink on any given day. I had proven time and time again that I could not stop on my own. And there's a little line in the foreword of our 12 and 12. I'm sorry, I know a couple of you have heard me speak over the last few months here, and I keep going back to this, but it's really been at the forefront of my mind during this time. I'm not exactly sure why yet. I'm sure I'll figure it out one day. But in the foreword of the 12 and 12, of all places, is this little line slid in there about AA's 12 steps being a group of principles, spiritual in nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. So again, you know, I first read that and kind of blurred right past it, but that has come to be one of the most meaningful lines in all of our literature for me. And it has been proven to me time and time again, if I am practicing these spiritual principles as a way of life, I can be happily and usefully whole. I don't just have to exist gritting my teeth, clenching my fist, trying to not drink, which was what I had tried to do for a while. And I need a solution. I think I've really come to value that line because just not drinking is not the solution for the kind of alcoholism that I suffer from. I've tried that. I've been there. And I'll tell you a little story before I backtrack and start at the beginning. But I had been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober young. My sobriety date's December 27th of 92. But I had tried coming to meetings for a handful of years before that. And you know, it wasn't that I didn't believe I was alcoholic. There were clear problems going on with me that were resulting from drinking, and not just outside problems, but I was having medical issues already because of my drinking at a very young age. So, you know, it wasn't that I doubted. I just didn't care yet. I didn't want to stop. I did not want people to tell me to stop living the way I was living and stop doing what I was doing and to stop drinking. So I kind of fluttered around Alcoholics Anonymous when someone first saw the condition I was in and suggested, hey, why don't you come check this out? It has helped me not drink for the last couple of years. And I very begrudgingly went. And I would come in and out and, you know, drink and come back and I wouldn't show up for a few weeks and people would see me at a meeting again and say, oh, where have you been? Have you been drinking? And I would be, oh, so offended. But of course I had been drinking, you know, they were absolutely right. Cause you guys know what it's like for me. But you know, don't you dare tell me that, but they were absolutely right. So I was kind of fluttering around and they said, this woman, Heather, is going to be your sponsor. And I said, I don't want one of those. I was belligerent. I was unwilling. I just did not care yet. And, you know, after a couple months of that, I had an experience on a weekend of drinking that I, with every cell in my body, wished I was not going to come out of. I was, I think, 17 years old at that time, and I was done. I was exhausted with life. I was hopeless. I had no will to live. I didn't want to be part of my own life, let alone yours and the rest of the world around me. I just wanted it to stop. And I had this weekend of, you know, mixing a lot of substances and drinking a lot of alcohol. And I hope I never forget. There are some instances, you'll probably hear me say that a couple times, because there are some really specific instances for me in my drinking that I do not want to forget, because they keep me remembering I am right where I'm supposed to be with you all today. And this was one of those weekends where, you know, I remember I was laying in a bed staring at a ceiling for most of the weekend, and one second it felt like my heart was pounding so hard it was going to burst out of my chest, and the next minute it felt like my heart was stopping, and I was in and out of sweats and in and out of consciousness, and just one of the worst physical weekends I can, time periods I can remember having. And I just wished, I think I even maybe prayed that this would be it, you know. But it obviously, I had the path ahead, so out of real terror, nothing else but sheer terror of the way I was living and experiencing things like that, I spent about 9 or 10 months not drinking, not taking anything minor mood altering, completely physically sober, but without any solution to my alcoholism. So, you know, as this time progressed, I kind of just never really went back to those AA meetings I had been trying to go to. I just thought, I'm going to hang in here and I'm not going to frickin' drink and we'll see how this goes, you know. And it was a progression of misery and craziness for me. The voices in my head that I used to drink to shut up had nothing to shut them up, and they went wild. I was living with a roommate who moved out because I was unbearable. I couldn't make it out of my room anymore because I didn't have something to drink to take away my fear of, oh my God, what if I encounter a person and they actually look at me and say something? What do I do? Because by that point, that's the kind of fear I was living in. And I was terrified of people. It just, I don't know why. I just had this drowning fear of people at that point. And it became unbearable, you know. My skin felt like it was crawling off all the time. I was pretty much confined to this room because I was afraid to leave it. I was in school for painting at the time and having these kind of blind rages in this dry state I was in. Things like punching the cinder block walls in my dorm room, breaking bones in my hand. I couldn't paint for months. And I didn't care. I had no will to do any of these things that were, I was supposed to be in the middle of in my life. What could have been a very lively, exciting time of life, right? And it became so miserable. I was living in such madness in my head that you bet I made a really conscious decision to drink again after this period of time. And I decided, I'm going to go to that party I heard about. I hadn't been going to any parties for a very long time. I don't know why I thought this would be. And I'm going to have 2 cans of beer. And I hated beer. I always chose the wine that I grew up drinking with my family that made wine, or the brandy, or, you know, the rum that I don't know why. Maybe I thought it would be safe. I said, I'm going to have 2 cans of beer at that party, and we'll just see what happens. I had no idea what I was asking for, but I'll tell you, I came to the next morning, and I was somehow back in my bed, and I couldn't move. Everything hurt. My head was pounding my body. I could tell something physically was very wrong. I had no recollection what had happened or how I had gotten back into my bed. And I finally made it to the bathroom and turned on the light, and the whole left side of my body was just blood, cut, dried, stuff stuck in open, gaping wounds on my body. Dirt, I was covered in throw up and parts of trees and leaves, and I had alcohol spilled on me, and I looked like I had been beaten to a bloody pulp, and I had no idea what happened. But I made my next conscious decision, which was, I'm just going to have to be more careful, because I'm not going to go back to the last 9 or 10 months of not drinking and living with that madness that was going on in my head and not being able to step out into the world and make it through a day and see people. So I told myself, I will just be careful. If I have consequences sometimes, I'm just going to have to suck it up and deal with it. I'm not going to not drink. I can't do it. I just can't. And I drank for another couple of years after that. So the reason I tell that story, like I said, I'm sorry, some of you heard me talk about that recently, but that 9 and a 12 and 12, it's so apparent once I came back to you all that just not drinking does not cure my alcoholism. I need a spiritual solution that is outlined in these steps and principles of Alcoholics Anonymous to treat what I got going on in here because it's loud and it's bad left by myself. So thank God I made it back to you all, you know, and that's what I think of often too, especially during this time. I'm seeing some people on some of my regular local meetings that are kind of coming and going, and, you know, the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous always welcomes me back, and we always welcome each other back into Alcoholics Anonymous, but I have no idea if I'm going to make it back the next time. So I know you all will take me in, but there is no guarantee that I'm going to make it. So the idea that it's a revolving door that I can just take my chances swirling through is not in my favor whatsoever. So thank God that you all have taught me, when I finally came back and found that sobriety date, what the solution really is to my alcoholism. And it has given me a way of life that is beyond anything I could have imagined when that guy sat on those stairs that day telling me I had 1 foot over the fence, right? I had no clue what was available here. So anyway, and I didn't know that, like it says in those lines, being happily and usefully whole. When I did finally come back, I thought, I'm just going to learn how to not drink. I was desperate. I, like I said, could not go to sleep, could not put my head down on a pillow at night and sleep if I didn't drink. And so that's what I came back wanting a solution to, and had no idea what else would unfold. So if you're new here tonight, or you're not too familiar yet or into sobriety, I hope you hang on for the ride, because it is unlike anything. We will try to describe it to you like I'm doing tonight, and people tried to describe it to me too, but I had to be in Alcoholics Anonymous to see what that was really about. So, you know, happily and usefully whole, what did that even mean to me? Nothing. I, like I said, I was desperate. I was lonely. I had alienated everybody in my life. My family felt like I was the alien baby out of those 5 kids. I was a part of this big family. Nobody knew what to do with me or what was wrong with me for a number of years before I came to you all. And I had started drinking early. I grew up in this big Italian family that I mentioned. My grandparents on my mom's side came from Italy. My dad's came from Poland. And my Italian grandparents grew grapevines over the back patio of their house in East Detroit, Michigan. And they made wine in barrels that were taller than I was at the time when I first remember being aware of it. And everybody got wine with dinner. You know, if you were a little kid, you just got a littler glass of wine. And there was something fascinating about it for me from the very, very beginning. There was something very mysterious and dreamy and kind of fantastical, you know, and I would look at my little crystal glass with that deep red wine in it and just be kind of entranced by this whole thing. And I would offer to help clean up so I could sip all the empty glasses of wine around the table, you know. And like I said, I was the youngest of 5 kids. Until the last handful of years, we thought I was the only one in the family. We should have had a suspicion, but I grew up in a pretty normal environment. You know, if you're the youngest of that many kids in a house full of people and it's a pretty decent family like mine was, I was taken care of. I had what I needed. I cannot point a finger and blame my alcoholism on something outside of myself. I can't say, well, that happened. That you would drink too. That's why I didn't have any of that going on. There was nothing outside of me that I can point the finger and say that's what drove me to drink the way that I ended up drinking, that led me to have liver function tests at the age of 19 years old coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous because there was something wrong with me. I didn't have that experience. So it was an inside job, right? Even the bad side of it. Nowadays in sobriety, we hear it's an inside job, you know, this path we're on to find a God of our understanding. But the negative was an inside job for me too, because that's where it was all churning and going on from an early, early point. And drinking, that wine became an answer from the very start, from a very abnormally young age. And it just increased as I got into school with friends that were sneaking out of the house drinking, all of that stuff that for them was just kind of normal growing up, rites of passage, experimenting, right? Getting in trouble, stopping. I wasn't, the stopping part I missed somewhere along the way. Get in trouble, just hide it better the next time. Have people question me, just learn how to lie better, right? So by the time I was, you know, early teen, I had a lot of different groups of people who I was telling a lot of different truths to. and I was having a hard time keeping things straight and remembering and not letting certain people see what I was doing over here. And I had my dear friend Erin. A couple of you have heard me always talk about her because she was a huge part of my growing up from the age of about 7 until I got sober finally at 19. She has not been a part of my life since. So I'll tell you more about that maybe if I remember to circle back around with amends. But, you know, Erin was kind of my caretaker. She's the one who would give me a piggyback ride home when we had snuck out at night. We would over the river and through the woods, for real for us. We would hop into those woods and climb through and go a couple miles to meet up with friends. And like I said, that one night of my back to drinking after a drive period, finding myself covered in leaves and stuff, I had this habit when I would be out drinking with people of, you know, the drama, oh, I had to get away and be by myself, and I would take off into the woods somewhere, and God, I don't know why, I don't know what that was all about, but Erin would find me, she would give me a piggyback ride if need be, get me home, get me into the house or under the back deck, hose me off if needed, because I would have been rolling around in my own mess, you know, before she knew my dad got up at about 5:36 in the morning. So I had my way in, and we were just having fun, I thought, right, until people like her saw some of what I was doing and started questioning me. So I think the first time I remember that happening, we were at a party, and the keg ran out, and everything in the parents' liquor cabinet had run out, and I'm tearing through cabinets, finding things like family-sized bottles of Robitussin and lemon and vanilla extract, and, you know, feeling like I had just saved the day, went gleefully up to Erin saying, look, 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 you know, this has alcohol in it. And that was the first time I remember her just looking at me. She had these beautiful crystal blue eyes, and I just remember her looking at me saying, there's something wrong with you, Debbie. What is wrong with you? And so it was also the first really aware moment of, I better not tell people some of what I'm doing. It wasn't a thought of, oh, maybe this is weird. Maybe I shouldn't drink the lemon extract. Maybe I shouldn't guzzle that giant bottle of Robitussin. You know, it was just a thought of, I better not tell her. She's somebody I can't trust, clearly, you know. And that proceeded for us the rest of my drinking. And I had a lot of episodes and things happening and breaking into houses and running around with the wrong kind of crowds that were stealing cars. And, you know, I was getting myself in a lot of trouble, and I started having those times of deciding I could not drink. I was going to have to go for that, just that Friday night of not drinking, you know, and Erin was with me one of those nights. I was determined like I had never been to not drink because of the trouble that was going on around me. And I got to that party with her. We always were tootling around in her little baby blue Volkswagen Bug. You know, that was our little runaround car. And we got to the party that night, and it was a hot, steamy August night in Virginia. And everything I just remember was wet. And I was sitting outside at a picnic table, and someone walked by and said, why are you not drinking? I was like, yeah, why am I not drinking? They put a bottle of rum down in front of me, and that was it. I don't remember changing my mind. I didn't even think it through. I didn't think about all the reasons that led up to why am I not drinking tonight. It was just over. That was it, you know. And again, that's just one of those many moments of nights like that. But there was a little difference that night. I ended up in the hospital, alcohol poisoning, my parents hysterical. The whole way home from that party, I was begging Erin. I'm leaning out the side of her little bug, throwing up down the side of her car, begging her to change shirts with me before she dropped me off at my parents' house, because I probably had spilled something on myself. I had thrown up. I had been rolling around in the woods because, like I said, I like to disappear out there. And I was a wreck. And I said, Erin, God, your mom doesn't care if you drink. You know how much trouble I'm in. I don't understand why you... This seemed to me a perfectly reasonable request of my best buddy, right? Just change clothes so I don't get in trouble. And I'm disgusting. And it was maybe the final time, really, that I remember the look in her eyes when she zoomed down the hill to the cul-de-sac where my parents' house was at the end of, and she said it again, there is something so wrong with you, and she leaned over, opened the door, and just pushed me out that time. She did not help me. That was her last effort with me. And like I said, you know, alcohol poisoning, hospital, the whole bit that night. So that's what happened to me when I would decide I was in too much trouble and I shouldn't drink. So it was very obvious that I was unable to not drink, no matter what kind of trouble was going on or decisions I was making. I was, you know, breaking into my family's houses. My sister, my dear sister, who I'm now extremely close to, and she is the sister I called crazy for so many years, is the one out of all of us that is full-time taking care of my mom after my dad passed away, and my mom had been in a assisted living facility, but it was soon after they moved there that my dad passed away, and my mom has some dementia and Alzheimer's going on, and then COVID happened, and she's suddenly completely isolated and sincerely losing her mind from that kind of isolation. So anyway, my brother, you know, busted my mom out of assisted living, and here's my sister now full-time taking care of her, which is no easy feat, and my sister has her own kids, but in my drinking, that's the sister whose house I broke into because my parents were going away again. I thought I was having a party. They knew what I was up to, and my sister and her husband come show up at the door, and they said, we're staying with you for the weekend, you know? So what, I just snuck out and had the party at their house and lied about it for years. When the police were there, they were fingerprinting. They thought someone had broken in. It was, and I just lied. I lied. I said to my sister, you're crazy. I was in the same house asleep that you were in last night. That was the kind of lack of conscience I was living with at the time, and the way I treated people that were trying to help in my life. And you can imagine it took many years in sobriety to make amends for that kind of destruction and damage and distrust caused with family. So thank God for the steps and for good sponsorship. I'll never forget, you know, I went through my amends process in the first couple years of sobriety, and then many years in, maybe, I don't know, I was like 10, 12, 13 years sober, and I said to my sponsor, Sharon, you know, there's something still going on with my sister. I feel like my amends with her is not complete. And she said, well, which sister, Debbie? You have 3, 4, I can't keep track. And I said, you know, the crazy one. Still, many years sober, referring to her that way. And there was kind of silence on the other end of the phone. And finally, my sponsor said, how about we start right now with you never again referring to her as the crazy sister. And from now on, you only say Sandy. I'm talking about Sandy when you and I are talking. Whew. Talk about multicolored world suddenly showing up in my life. This was such a concept I could not have even fathomed, but it reminded me of what a sponsor I had very early on said, which is, you're not quite ready for your amends because you haven't had a change of heart yet. You're still, you know, you just read me your 8-step list and you're calling your dad the unemotional army colonel who has no feelings, and you're referring to your mom as the crazy over-emotional who's always crying one. Clearly, you have not had a change of heart with the people in your life, and your amends are not going to be sincere, so you have some more work to do, you know? Again, thank goodness for good sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous that have steered me when I was veering way off here, that kind of rein me back in and get me on a track again. I can't do this stuff on my own. My alcoholic head does not lead me on the right track left to my own devices. So anyway, that was the beginning of a whole deeper level of amends with that sister of mine when Sharon said that to me at a number of years sober. Stop calling her crazy. And it's true. I did have a significant change of heart with her. She's not one of us. She's not an alcoholic. She's got some kind of ism going on. But these days, that does not, my alcoholism and her own stuff does not rule our relationship. We have a sistership and a friendship that is based on mutual love and respect, you know. And when I was a number of years sober, sitting at her table with her three boys, and somebody's house had been broken into, and her youngest son was little and afraid, and he said, "Mom, what if someone breaks into our house? Has someone ever broken into our house before?" And I thought, oh, geez, here we go. You know, that's my godson, Christopher, her youngest. His whole little picture of Aunt Debbie is about to shatter, because he's going to hear all about how the time I broke into their house and lied about it for years, right? And that sister, so not crazy, just her first and foremost concern was her kids' well-being. And she said, "Christopher, we're perfectly safe. Nothing like that's happened or will happen in our household." And just moved on. And I thought, oh, my God. I would miss all this. You know, I would do so much destruction on my own. So anyway, it's been a long road of repairing things like that. But I first came around AA, like I said, when I was 17. And I was living in ways that I was so ashamed of, I didn't know what to do but keep drinking to try and not pay attention to how I was living. You know, I learned at a very early age, if you do what people want, they will give me what I want. So I had all of that kind of mess going on, to the point where I couldn't even look at myself in a mirror to brush my hair or put makeup on, really, because I was so disgusted with that incomprehensible demoralization our book talks about I was living in, for sure. And when someone first suggested I come with them to Alcoholics Anonymous, I told you already, I wasn't ready. I wasn't willing. I didn't really want to stop. I wanted my life to change, but I didn't know what that meant, and I didn't know how. And so after that episode of coming to looking like I'd been beaten to a bloody pulp, I asked people what happened that night. All they told me was, "We were at this party, the police were coming, and we all had to leave, and you were belligerent and refused to leave. So we had to try dragging you down this long gravel driveway, and then you got in a fight with somebody, and then. It was all, there you go." So that was my first night back. So anyway, I spent a couple of years drinking after that. And experiencing a kind of loneliness, not just being alone, because I can be alone today at peace and ease, right, like our book talks about. But I was wallowing in that loneliness and the despair and not knowing how to keep going, what to do next, how to not drink. And there was one thing I remembered about those meetings I had been in. I really didn't remember what people had said to me. But what I remembered was there was a light in those people's eyes that I had seen in those meetings, you know, because it was still me and them at that time. But I just remembered there was something about them that looked so much more alive than anything I was feeling. I felt like this dead soul that happened to be trapped in a body that was like a marionette. You know, somebody else was pulling the strings. I was going through the motions. But I felt dead inside. And I remember those people in those AA meetings did not look that way at all. And I remembered them talking and laughing and talking to each other about meaningful stuff. Again, I couldn't really remember what, but I would just remember having heard them talking, thinking, oh, why would you ever tell somebody something that personal and that humiliating and that threatening about yourself? I couldn't grasp being open with another human being. So I had one phone number. It turned up on a scrap. I lifted my old dial phone on the shelf in my dorm room, and I lifted it up, and there was a piece of paper with Heather's number on it. That woman, they said, would have been my sponsor, and I said, no, I don't want one. But there was her number. I don't know how it was there years later, having moved about 3 times in that time frame. But it was there, and I called, and that was the beginning of my journey, actually, in sobriety, in Alcoholics Anonymous, with all of you. And there was a different surrender that was happening for me at the time. I didn't like it still. I wasn't comfortable. I had no idea what I was really doing in the middle of you all. And you know, I'm kind of relieved people didn't give me a chance to sit around and think about it too much to try and figure it out. They started saying things like, come with us, come to this meeting, come to this service thing, come to this mini conference that WAIA is putting on. Come with us to pick up this person who's even newer and crazier than you are. I mean, they would actually say that to me, you know, newer and crazier than you are. I was so defeated, I couldn't even be offended at that point. I just, fine, I'll go, whatever, right? But something different happened, and I started doing what other people in Alcoholics Anonymous were doing, which included, most importantly, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and starting those amends process that I talked about in my inventory and the 10 steps, you know, all of it, not a piece of it, but all of it, really. And what has come about as a result of that, I don't even know where to start next. I told you about the amends with that sister. When I was about 2.5 years sober, I kind of on a whim applied for a program for painting, a graduate painting program overseas in Italy. I had always wanted to go there. I wanted to see where my family was from. I just felt this weird internal, I felt like I needed to go there. And I knew I'd be starting grad school. I just applied on a whim. And I remember the day I got the letter, and I opened the letter and I called my sponsor. I said, this letter says I've been accepted. I don't know what to do. And my sponsor said, well, you go. What do you mean? What do? You go. That's the next indicated thing. You've been accepted. This is a fantastic opportunity. You're an art. You go to that program and you go study painting in Italy and you learn whatever you can learn from the teachers. That's exactly what you do. And you make your age, you know, they talked me through everything. And I was going to be living in a place. It was a tiny little hill town of only 500 people, almost no one spoke English. There were no meetings in Italian at the time in that town, let alone in English. So I would travel a couple times a week, walk down the mountain, take a bus to Camachia, get on a little train that chugged so slow for 2 hours to Florence that wind didn't blow in the windows, you know. There was no email. Nobody had email at the time. I couldn't email people to see how I was doing. Nobody could email me. Once a week, I would go up to the top of the town and use that little payphone and my mom's calling card and call my mom, call my sponsor, you know. Every now and then if I was splurging, I would call a friend in AA. And I wrote letters, like handwritten, real old-fashioned letters. And friends mailed me tapes and CDs, not CDs, tapes. I had that little yellow Panasonic Walkman. And at night, I would lay in my bed and I would listen to AA speaker tapes. And right before I went was when my sponsor had made that comment about not being ready for my amends because of the way I was still talking about people like my parents. And my sponsor said, you need to have this change of heart. And I was getting ready to go, and my dad was trying to talk to me, and I was still on very uncomfortable terms with my dad at about 2.5 years sober. I didn't see him a lot. If I did, we didn't talk. I didn't really want to know anything, and I didn't really want to tell him anything. And I had developed this attitude of, I don't need anything, I can take care of myself. Bad attitude, right? But I had it in sobriety still. And I thought, I'm trying to be a grown-up and trying to be responsible and not take anything from my parents, you know? So don't help me. I don't want it, and I don't need it. And when I was getting ready to go, my dad had recently been to Italy, and he was telling me, you know, when you go to St. Peter's in Rome, look at this and look at that. And Debbie, slow down enough to look at the detail. And inside I'm getting rageful, thinking, what does he think I've been doing all these years painting? Of course I look at the detail. Of course, you know, snotty little attitude that I had. And so my sponsor heard all this in conjunction with that 8-step list I was reading and said, You'll do your nine step when you're back, but while you're there, you write your dad, not your mom because she's easy, you write your dad letters and you tell him what you're observing on any given day and what you're painting and why you're painting that and what's beautiful that you're seeing around you. That sounds pretty no big deal, but at the time it made me break out in a cold sweat because I felt like I'm so distant from that man. There is no possible way I can write him anything, which to me is so personal and so vulnerable about how I see the world around me and why I choose to paint what I paint. You know, I just couldn't imagine having the guts to write it and actually send it to him knowing he was going to get it and read it. I think that's normal human interaction. For me, it felt it felt horrifying. But I did what my sponsor said, and my letters at first were probably not quite as personal as I was supposed to be making them, but I was writing them, and I would get cards back, and my mom would have written the letter, and my dad would sign his, you know, love. He would always write, L-U-V, Dad, and I knew that that was his handwriting. And then somewhere through the summer, he started writing letters back to me, just my dad. And by the time I got home from that period of living in Italy, my dad and I were on a different footing. And I no longer viewed him because in his letters back, he would tell me about how he saw the world and experiences he had had. And suddenly it's two human beings relating to one another. Without Alcoholics Anonymous, I cannot do that. I'm not capable. My drinking takes precedence and I don't care about you. So something was changing, you know, and I was able to start living in more of an amends with the people around me. And that continued into sobriety. And we were at a family funeral. I was about 14 or 15 years sober, and there were a lot of people at this funeral because my brother and his wife who died were just very loved in the community, and there were a lot of people there, but you know how we are. AA people make their presence known whether they mean to or not, because people were coming up to me saying, who are all these friends of yours? They're cleaning up plates before we can even finish eating, you know, because we're taught to try and be useful. Where so A, people are going around the reception trying to help clean and put things away and just be useful at this funeral and this reception. And when we were at the cemetery and, you know, we all paid our respects and everyone was going and saying a prayer over the coffin. And I went and stood by my dad after I said my prayer. And then we watched, you know, all the A people that have been sitting together go by and say their prayer and keep going. And my dad finally just leaned down and said, you have the greatest people in your life of anybody else in our family. You just keep doing this. You just keep doing this. Because it was a long time into AA before my family accepted that I needed to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. And why couldn't they have helped me? But suddenly all these strangers are helping me. Right? There's so much more to that, but you get that idea. It had been a long time for them to become not only comfortable, but then extremely grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. And it started, my love it, my sponsor talks about one of us gets sober and it's like a pebble in a pond and the ripples just go, right? And that's what was happening in my family. Now I get these calls like my brother, hey, I got a swimmer. They're one of you. Where can they go to a meeting when they visit this state or this town? You know, it's just how it is now. And they know that. And then when I was, right before that funeral, the year before, I was going to do something that I had always wanted to do. I had read for years. Billy Lynn, sorry, you guys have heard all this before. But it has to do where things have ended up more recently with my dad. So I was going to climb a mountain in the Andes. I had read for years about high altitude climbing, mountaineering, technical stuff, right? I thought I could never do that. And there was this opportunity that came up and a group going to climb for raising funds for the exact same type of breast cancer that my brother's wife had. And here, and once again, I call my sponsor, what do I do? She, you know, same thing. You go, Debbie. This was just dropped in your lap. You have been wanting to go climb that mountain for 2 years now. You said it was impractical. Now there's a purpose greater than you behind it. It has to do with your amends and your brother and his wife. You go climb the mountain. Fine, I go. But leading up to it, my mom was furious because all she's thinking is, high altitude, people die. I've read all about that stuff. And meanwhile, my dad snuck me down to his workroom in the basement and started reaching up to the rafters in the ceiling, pulling out his rolled up topographical maps of the mountains he used to climb in Alaska when they lived there in the 60s. And I had no idea about this and about my dad. I had no clue. So even that many years sober, I'm still learning. I'm still getting to know my dad, right? I'm still softening my own edges enough thanks to the work I'm doing in AA. And honestly, I learned how to give love to people through sponsorship, my sponsor, but even more so the women I sponsor and working with them and seeing what unconditional love truly is and taking another human being through the steps and watching their lives change, right? So that is what let me be open-hearted enough to be on this new journey with someone like my dad. So then he and I have this bond over this intense passion and love for wild places and the mountains, and we had our own thing, you know. Because it worried my mom so bad, I would just not tell her, but my dad would hear I was going on a trip, and I would come back, and he would say, okay, tell me what you were doing there. I know you were going to climb something, and you just didn't want to, you know. So we had our own little private, wonderful bonding going on, and for years I heard him talk about things like the mountain in Alaska that he would climb all the time when they lived there. And so last summer, actually just exactly a year ago, my husband and I went to Alaska to climb that mountain that my dad used to climb all the time. And, you know, we climb things all the time in Colorado, but we're not starting at sea level. We were starting from sea level there. And the whole way up that mountain, I kept it, you know, we climbed about a little over 6,000 feet from sea level to the summit of that mountain. So it's not the elevation of ours, but it was a lot more rise to gain in that one climb. And partway up, not too far from under the summit, we realized we had cell phone service, and we said, let's call my dad and tell him we're here on his mountain, you know. And he, I had gone on his last trip to Alaska ever a number of years before that. He was never able to return because of his physical condition. And he showed me that place for the first time through his eyes. He took me to an AA meeting, to the group in Anchorage. Some of you probably know this great meeting. My dad dropped me off at my AA meeting on that trip, and I was many years sober then, you know. And I shared about him that night, about how I was on this trip with him, and I never could have imagined that happening. And people flooded out after the meeting. They saw me getting into the car, and they all came rushing over to his window saying things like, sir, you have no idea how much your daughter loves you. And I'm, like, cringing because I still have a little bit of that, you know, afraid to be that way with my dad. But the AA people helped it happen, right? My dad, you could just see him light up. He couldn't believe I'd been talking about him in that way to all these people. So anyway, AA has helped in so many more ways than I can tell you about. But so here my husband and I are partway up this mountain last July. And we called him, and he answered, because, of course, he'd been waiting by his phone. And he said, are you at the summit? Are you at the summit? I said, oh, Dad, not quite. We still have a little ways to go, but we are a good ways up this mountain, and we can see this glacier and that glacier that you have pictures of. And you could just hear how completely unimpressed he was that we were not yet at the summit of that mountain, right? But then my sister, of course, on the other end, tells me that all day long, all he kept saying to anyone at the house was, Debbie's on my mountain today. Debbie's climbing my mountain today, right? So anyway, my dad passed away in December, and he had a long, good life. It wasn't unexpected. It wasn't a tragic early death, nothing like that. But leading up to it for a couple of years, I was really going through the process of, where is God in all this? I have got to have a deeper relationship with God so I don't really fall into that wondering of, what is this all about, right? Why are we here? I mean, I've always heard my sponsor remind me, we're touch favorably on the lives of somebody else, be of maximum service, you know, and that's what we do. Thank God, that's what we do here. But I didn't want to go too deep into that. Yeah, but what's the point, really? So a couple years leading up to his death, I knew this was happening, and I had a great sense of peace knowing he was out of his suffering, because he was living in a physical condition that was so far from the man who had climbed mountains and fished offshore for all the years of his life, right? So it was his time. And we were completely at peace when he passed away. And there was none of that discomfort or that inability to sit in a room next to him and try and hide what my life was about, you know. And he had driven cross country with me when I moved out here to Colorado 8 years ago. He'd come back a number of times since. And where my mom was just distraught that I moved away, my dad would say things like, I understand, you're in the kind of place that I love and wished I could have ended up in, you know. And he always wanted to hear what it was like. I would go on these crazy climbs and my mom would be mad and my dad would say, tell me everything about it. I always wondered what it would be like at 20,000 feet. I never climbed that high. I want to hear from you what it's like. So now I feel like it's going to be my dad's turn to help me see what it's like, right, when we leave this temporary earthly body. Because I don't know. I don't know what I believe about all that. I know there is a God working in my life that is so loving and beyond powerful and has brought me experiences and relationships with other human beings that I could never have, I could not drink. You know, I think the first sense I had of this great power was coming into a meeting a couple months sober, convinced I was going to have to drink before I went to bed that night. I was in such a compulsion to drink. And by the end of the meeting, I no longer felt that way. And it was very obvious. There was a power in that room of collective energy that was so much stronger than I was by myself. So I knew this. I've believed that for a very long time. But I just don't really know what I believe after this lifetime, you know? And my husband and I were snowshoeing in March, right before everything shut down. And a lot of times when I'm in the mountains, I think about my dad. That's my place to connect with my God and my dad. And just my sense of inner peace is where I find it. But we were snowshoeing with our dogs, and we'd been going up for a couple hours. And we finally came to a clearing in the trees on the side of this mountain. And it's magnificent, this trail. It's just you step out of the trees and the entire ridge of the mountain you're on rises up to the right and circles up in front of you. And on the left is the ridge of another mountain. So you're closed in this open snow bowl between these two mountains. And it's one of those just mind-blowing, magnificent scenes. And as I stepped with my husband and one dog were ahead of us, and my other dog and I stepped out of the trees, and as I was coming out of the trees into that clearing, I hadn't thought about my dad at all that day. But I heard myself internally, you know, that voice, hi, Dad, that same happy, eager voice that I used to get. And in that very second, this massive wind just swept through this entire mountain bowl that we were standing. I mean, even my little dog, Ginger, who adored my dad. You could see Ginger's little nose like following the wind around the same way it was this wacky, wacky moment. And I just knew his presence was permeating that whole place, right? And I think it was his way of letting me know that he's climbing his mountains again and doing the things he loves, right? Because he's free of all those bodily constraints and ailments that he had. But I also knew, I think my dad is going to be my bridge to understanding something greater. So all those years I spent telling him about what the views were like on these different mountains, and my dad is going to show me what that view is next. So that might sound kind of weird and hokey. but talk about feeling the presence of a loving power in our lives, you know. And I get to convey when I'm working with this young woman I sponsor now who's a couple months sober. She has a couple kids. She got out of an abusive relationship, and she's struggling with her relationship with her dad, and she does not believe it's going to change. So every one of these experiences we have, it's not about me. It's about what we can share with each other to help us get to the other side and not have to go back to drinking and living the way that we used to drink and live to make it through a day or not make it through a day, you know? So much greater. I just came here hoping to not drink. And I am afforded this life that I cannot put a price tag on. And so what I have to share with those women are the experiences that have brought about the amends process, the service work that got me out of my self-centered ways of being, right? I answer the phone. I keep my ringer on at night. People answered the phone for me when I called crazy in the middle of the night when I was newly sober. I don't turn my ringer off at night. I have my phone, and it buzzes, and it wakes me up if it needs to. And they know if they need to call, they can call if something's really wrong. And my life has become not about me. I'm married to a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I could not have asked for a more meaningful journey in a partnership than that. We know what it means that we both have to sustain, maintain our spiritual condition on a daily basis. And that is a gift that I would not have imagined or even thought would come into my life. And I don't know, I think that's about it. I'm out of time anyway. I think there were a bunch of other things I meant to share about tonight, but there you go. Clearly all that, like I said, a few of you have heard that recently, but that's just been at the forefront of my awareness and thinking these days. So I'm really glad to be with you all. It's great to see you. Thanks for having me here.